welcome back to Action Phase. I'm your host, Tegan Keating. This week, I talk with Dr. Timmerie Schmidt. She is a sexuality educator and an AFA-certified fitness instructor. She does a huge range of things over the course of a week. She bikes around Philadelphia, going from gym to gym, getting people fit. She teaches classes at the university level, and then she also teaches classes that are open to the public. And I know her because my fiance Nathan Karuna produces her podcast called Sex with Timmerie, which is a similar format to this one, but obviously a little different, focused on sex and sexuality. So she talks to people from like people who produce erotica to people who are doing research in the area of human sexuality to, she had a topless rights advocate on the show. I mean, she really, like, it's a huge, they've been doing it for years. So I suggest that you check it out, not just because I have a, you know, I'm personally invested in it, but because it is a genuinely interesting show. And I think you'll get a good sense of the sex positiveness and the inclusiveness that Timmerie brings to her work in this interview that I do with her. So, you know, briefly, we talk about her evolution of becoming a sex educator and why it was important to her, and also like why being a fitness instructor is really important for her, like not only physically, because, you know, endorphins, but also like the impact that being a part of somebody else's fitness journey has on her emotionally. You know, it's good to hear that part, because we often in public health talk about increasing people's exercise and getting people to move more. But, you know, she's one of those people who's actually out there doing it and like getting people to get their heart rate up, break a sweat, and, you know, it's nice to kind of hear that side of it. So, and then, you know, we kind of conclude with why talking about sexuality, not just sex, not just sexual behavior, but sexuality itself, is really important when we talk about public health. And we focus primarily on trans issues, but, you know, that can kind of, you can kind of extrapolate from there. So, yeah, she's got a lot to say. I had a lot to say. Let's just get right to it. Here she is, Timmerie Schmidt. I'm here with Dr. Timmerie Schmidt. She is a sexuality educator and an AFA certified fitness instructor.
Hey.
Hi. How's it going?
I'm good.
Good. So Timmerie is very used to the setup that we have right now, because this is where she records her podcast, at my dining room table in my living room.
It's kind of tripping me out that I didn't introduce this. And I was like, wait, yeah.
Yeah. And you're using the other mic.
What?
I know. Not the one with the big round thing, pop guard or whatever it's called.
I think I'll adjust. I'll figure it out eventually.
I think it's not that difficult to switch from one to another.
I took some postgraduate work in how to talk into a microphone. Yeah.
I'm sure that there are those classes out there, like voiceover.
We should teach them.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Cool. Business venture. So tell me a little bit about how you got interested in sexuality and fitness, and what like your journey through all of that has been like.
So I get asked the question fairly often, like, why did I go into sexuality education? I think a lot of people in sex get asked that question. But from my vantage, I didn't understand why not everybody goes into it, because like what it's an insanely interesting topic. You can do a different thing every single day. I mean, if you work in like a specific office, like you just work in HIV, then you're just going to do HIV. You're just going to do domestic violence, whatever. But you could theoretically do so many different things, because it touches on every topic. And as a young person, I found the topic interesting and didn't have that squeamish reaction that a lot of people do. And so I felt very comfortable talking about it with people. So it became just a known thing that I was someone you could go talk to as a teenager about whatever, like first time sex, about, you know, weird bodily things, about, you know, relationship stuff. I had just read and talked to people so much that I just had the information that was available, but other people did not know how to find. And then I was just like, well, I like doing this. It seems like not everybody feels comfortable doing this. And it really seems important to everybody that I talk to. Like, they come to me with this incredible weight on them, because how are you going to solve this problem? Seems solutionless, but it's clearly important to their lives. And so I was like, why would I not do this? And then while in grad school, for my PhD in human sexuality, I started being a fitness instructor, just because it's always been another passion, health in general. Obviously, I find bodies fascinating. So that just started as a job, and it turned out to be like one of the loves of my life. So fitness and sexuality have a lot of overlap, and so I just kept finding out more and more and building it together and separately. Yeah.
I've heard, so I used to live upstairs from an apartment that was a bunch of Widener PhD students.
Oh, nice.
Lived there. There were three of them, and then two of them moved out, and then two more students moved in, like so many. And everyone that I asked said pretty much the same thing, that they were the go-to person in their high school for sex information. I don't think that they had, that there was one of those in my high school.
Really?
I don't think so. I mean,
what might have happened is I think that person exists everywhere, but how the community reacts to them will affect how they put it out there. Like, so I didn't care if people called me a slut. Like, I wasn't sexually active, but I was talking about it. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing the things that people were asking questions about, but I still had the information. And for many people, to have that be the way you're described as the slutty one, the freaky one, whatever, that will shut that down.
Mm.
And that's going to be the end of your putting yourself out there in that way. And so maybe somebody had that information, but they were doing it like all online, or, you know, they only kept it to their friend group or something like that.
And you just didn't care.
No, I mean, I went to a tiny little school, and I was never going to be part of what was normal there anyway. Like, that was never going to happen. I was openly queer. I didn't dress like they did. I was interested in things that they weren't interested in, and it was like never going to work. So why bother?
Right. Like, yeah.
I'm not going to fit in. So whatever.
So then you went to college, did the regular college thing. And then you went to grad school. Did you go right to Widener, or did you do a master's first?
So immediately upon graduating undergrad, I first applied to a master's program in marriage and family therapy, because that was the only thing that I found. Mm-hmm. This was before I knew about Widener existing. There, at that time, you know, the internet existed, but like institutions weren't as good about being present there.
Right.
So it wasn't actually that normal for a graduate program to have a website. In like 2004, like that was Googleable. It's weird to think about it that way.
That's hard to imagine.
Yeah, but like I would spend hours online looking. I mean, I lived on the internet like a lot of young people did, but so I was fairly savvy about how to find this stuff, but that's not what those kind of folks did, people that run schools.
They barely do now.
Yeah, so you can only imagine. It's like over 10 years ago. And I would find blog entries that were like 3 or 4 years old of somebody who had put together links of places you could study, and it was mostly international. And a lot of links didn't work anymore. Some of them were for programs that weren't actually holding classes anymore. And what I thought was my best bet was this program in San Francisco. And I applied to it. And again, speaking of how they didn't have their internet-ness together, I filled out what I thought was the whole application. There was a second part somewhere else. And when I kept being like, okay, so when should I hear back? When should I hear back? Like months of pastoring this school, eventually they did get back to me. They're like, oh, you didn't fill out half the application. I was like, oh, things that could have been mentioned at any point while I was emailing and calling you. Anyway, it was the best mistake I ever made, because I don't want to be doing the work that would have enabled me to do.
And you don't want to be a therapist.
No, I don't. And I don't want to be doing specifically, you know, like marriage and family counseling.
Right.
And that's exactly what that degree was. But that was what I thought was my best bet. So I spent a year, it was 2004, just volunteering for political campaigns. And in the course of that, found the Widener program. And that's where I got my master's and my PhD.
Oh, okay. And now you teach there, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. The student becomes the teacher, literally.
I didn't know that was my dream until I was there.
And really?
This was my thing. And I am incredibly lucky because a lot of people come in and they're like, what? I could train other sexuality educators? Because that's like meta level.
Right.
You know, you get to influence how sexuality education is done.
Mm-hmm.
Not just what you're doing, but how other people are going to do it. So to get to work directly with populations, like I still get to do that. I get to, you know, teach... I also teach like CCP, so I'll be teaching people who are just doing an intro level, mm-hmm. like that sort of thing.
That'll be great because you'll be able to really, when you're not working with people who want to specialize in that field, everything you say could potentially be like brand new to these people.
Oh, yeah. Working in sex, you blow someone's mind every day. Like,
That's awesome. Stuff
that I think is pretty basic, but like somebody just never conceptualized.
Like what?
Well, here, this is sort of a random example. So on my podcast, Sex with Simmery, I had a conversation literally last week with someone who his life is very much organized around a kink of his, that he's very into exposing himself and being humiliated and degraded. That's his favorite thing. And it's a pretty big part of his life. And he thinks about it a lot, but he's never talked to anybody about it. And so he hasn't had like a lot of bouncing back and forth and like learning about other vantages other than his own. And just through some really quick exchanges with him, he had never thought about, so if you go and expose yourself in public, how might other people feel about that? So, like, from his point of view, you know, he liked it. You know, someone would laugh at him and they would make fun of him and would call him names. And I was like, so what do you think about the fact, like, you might expose yourself to someone and their reaction is that they feel unsafe and they feel traumatized by that. And he was like, I wouldn't want that. That would be terrible. I would never want that to happen. And I'm like, so are you doing anything to prevent that? And he just literally never contemplated it before. Like, really, to me, that was pretty step one.
Yeah.
To him, it was not. And because he did not feel safe discussing it with anyone, he was never going to just have that insight on his own, evidently.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean.
So, and he had just never talked to anybody about.
Through the course of our conversation, he revealed that he had, you know, he'd hired various women to like indulge his kink. And mm-hmm. so he would tell them honestly what he was into. I don't think he like discussed it in great detail about,
right.
you know, the motivation or like how this is affecting his life, certainly.
Right.
And he had spoken to a therapist briefly right before she retired and did not really feel like prepared to go start over with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was the first person with whom he'd ever really had a substantive conversation about this.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really powerful.
In his whole life. And this man has lost marriages over this. Like,
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is an incredible position for you to be in.
It's,
knowing that that's the kind of thing that you can do.
It's not uncommon for sex educators. For people who meet someone in an elevator, meet someone, you know, in a hotel lobby, you're waiting for a bus, whatever, and you're just making conversation and you're like, I'm a sex educator. It happens all the times people in my field that some complete stranger will then unload a huge part of their relationship issues, their sexuality dysfunction, something of that nature, that they won't even tell their partner of 17 years. That you now know stuff that they've never told anyone else.
And you didn't want to be a therapist, but you find yourself in these kinds of conversations that, I mean,
yeah.
generally people would have with a counselor.
Maybe, hopefully they would tell a counselor. I think a lot of people are scared of that too.
Why do you think that is?
Why are they scared to
yeah.
be honest about this stuff?
Yeah.
There's so much stigma. There's the fear and very realistic fear of judgment. For instance, the guy that I was just talking about, when he had gone to a counselor, he asked her at one point, is this making you uncomfortable? Like, he asked her, like, if talking about mm-hmm. the exposing himself was making herself squeamish. And she said, a little. And then that shut him down because he didn't want to creep her out. That wasn't what he was there for. He, you know, so he actually was going to scale back how much he talked about it. So that's a therapist giving him this, you know, sort of a yellow light.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine the average person who hasn't had a lot of training and in a lot of relationships, someone will come forward with their kink or like the thing they want to try or some part of their identity, and their partner's reaction may actually not be that upset, but they feel like they have to be upset about it so that they don't look freaky.
That's really confusing.
I've heard lots of relationships where that happened. Like, perfect example would be like a husband comes to a wife about a cross-dressing thing. That's a mm-hmm. pretty common scenario. And the wife, her actual reaction internally, if she really thinks about it, is like, she's mad about getting lied to. You know, she's upset about money being wasted. You know, she feels like a little bit freaked out by it. But in reality, the big reaction that she gives is, if I act like I'm okay with this, I'm condoning it, and this is immoral, and then people will think that I'm a freak and I'm a lesbian and like all of these other things. And they give this big defensive reaction for those reasons, and then also because it's a power play. Because if you act like you're super freaked out, you're immediately in this position over them.
Mm.
And so it gives you this leverage. So in this relationship, you now are the normal one and they're the bad one.
So what do you, let's say that relationship dynamic is playing out. What kind of effect does that have on other people, or not on other people, in those people in other parts of their lives?
So if you can't communicate honestly about sex, like how does that affect your relationship?
How does having either a secret kink or a strange power dynamics in your relationship affect your ability to do your job correctly? I mean, I know it's different for every person, but what are, you know, have you talked about that at all? Like what the greater impact of sexuality issues on somebody's life?
Yeah. So, I mean, you definitely nailed that. Like, really, really does depend, and depends on what the secret is, depends on what, you know, the job is, those sort of things. The thing that comes to me over and over again is people who, because they're unable to be honest about stuff, it leads to unsafe sexual behaviors. Like,
okay,
people who are sort of like, you know, in the stages of change theory, they're like in the denial phase. And so they're not going to use protection. They're not going to disclose to partners, or more specifically, they're not going to go get tested for something
mm-hmm.
because, you know, STIs and HIV happen to certain types of people in their brain. That's how it works. It's not based on behaviors. Behaviors that are risky put you at risk. Rather, they want to conceptualize it. It happens to gay Latino men between 18 and 25, you know, like that.
Right. And that's it.
And I'm not one of those.
Right.
So I'm not at risk, even though I'm having unprotected sex with someone who I know occasionally uses heroin intravenously.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And that level of denial and that level of not really talking openly about what behaviors you're engaging in, or people who want to conceptualize themselves as being good partners, but they're doing something else on the side. And so rather than having an open conversation about opening up their relationship, being like polyamorous, you know, swinging, etc., they just like do it anyway. And they want like permission from, like, I'll get emails sometimes from like somebody who's married, and for whatever reason the married sex isn't going very well, for reasons that I could probably figure out, you know, through the fact that they're not talking about it. They're, mm-hmm. you know, they usually have kids, like that sort of thing. And so they're talking about what they're doing on the side. Either they're going to like massage parlors, or they're like finding hookups online, or whatever the case may be. And they're writing me essentially to just get it off their chest, but kind of to get permission. And I'm like,
oh, they come to you saying, you know, is this all right?
Yeah, I think that because if you're a sexuality educator, you're probably just cool with whatever.
Mm.
That's what they think,
right?
And what I'm telling them is like, I'm not your priest,
you right?
know. What I'm here for is to tell you like what are the specific risks at which you're putting yourself. Here are ways that you could talk to your partner about what it is that you want, you know, here, you know, that sort of thing. That's what I'm here for. Like, I'm not going to tell anybody, you know, we still have the confidentiality, but I'm not here to absolve you. So your choices are yours. And like, I hear those stories like more than I would have ever expected. The number of people who, are rationalizing behaviors that they know are dangerous.
It's amazing to me. We definitely talk about this a lot with HIV and MSM, men who have sex with men, mm-hmm. and that there are men who consider themselves straight, but consistently have risky sex with other men.
Oh yeah.
And it's difficult for me to imagine how you can just like separate that. You can just say, that's something that I did on Friday, and like, that's not me, but you're the one who did it. There's mm-hmm. like some, I don't know what that psychological term for that is.
There's a couple things going on there. One is, you know, for people who are actually probably oriented to be gay, one of the problems with coming out initially is if the only models of what it looks like to be gay, what it looks like to be a lesbian that you see are these stereotypes, and you're like, but I'm not like that. I mean, like, I don't play softball. I don't have short hair, whatever. Like, so that's probably not me. That's not what I am then. Mine is something else. And it takes a really long time to eventually figure out, but I'm pretty much most of the time attracted to the same sex, and that's ultimately what that's about. Mm-hmm. So okay, maybe I should just acknowledge that I am, in fact. And so some people, that's why it takes them until they're adults to come out,
right?
You know, because like, you grow up in a small town and literally the only other gay person is not like you,
right?
You know, so whatever. But then on the other end of the spectrum, like, people conceptualized orientation as being this very static thing. Mm-hmm. Your whole life, it's the exact same thing, and it manifests the same way all the time, and that's not really true.
Right.
Realistically, that's not true. You have the behaviors you engage in, you have the fantasies that are in your head, and then you have what you actually identify as, you know, and they may not line up. But like, you know, if you mostly prefer women, but you're a guy and you end up in prison for a while, and you decide to have sex with men there, it doesn't change your orientation, but it certainly changes your behavior.
Right.
And you could choose to identify as gay while you're in there if you wanted to. I don't think that would be probably the safe prison choice.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And, you know, there's also this perception around male homosexuality specifically that what's gay is being the receptive partner, like in anal sex.
Really?
Or giving blowjobs. That's gay. But getting a blowjob or fucking a dude in the ass, that might just be getting off. That's a less gay thing to do.
That's really
especially among machismo culture.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that because being the receptive partner is, that's like the more feminine mm-hmm. role? So yeah. that's like a super sexist.
Well, most homophobia is ultimately sexism. It's ultimately misogyny. Most homophobia is driven by the idea that why would you do the thing that women do?
Mm.
Like, why would you give your male power away and like give sexual pleasure to a man? Like, that is the sin.
That makes me so sad.
It is.
Like, that's terrible.
It's ultimately just misogyny that's like slightly veiled. Yeah. So by ceding your masculine power, you know, by identifying as gay, I mean, that in that culture, that would be a bad idea, even though you really like making out with dudes.
Right.
Yeah,
I guess nobody has really couched homosexuality in those terms for me, that it is just, I mean, it is veiled misogyny.
And that's part of why people often have a much harder time with gay men than with gay women. They see them as less of a threat.
Interesting.
To take a completely ridiculous, you know, stretch example, Godwin's law, we're on the internet. The Nazis actually didn't execute any lesbians.
I mean, only gay men.
Probably some lesbians were killed, yes, but they weren't rounding them up and treating them the same way they treated gay men, because they considered lesbianism to be a temporary affliction that could be corrected, and that women ultimately, given the opportunity, would go to their naturally prescribed role of mother and, you know, like, go have Aryan babies. Right. So don't kill them because they could, you know, be contributing to this society. Gay men, though, were perceived as being like intrinsically different. And it was
because no man would do that unless there was something wrong with them.
Yeah, that was the argument. And so what are the Nazis all about but deciding that certain people are intrinsically different? Right. And so that's why they were conceptualized that way. But I guess on some level, I guess they understand that like attraction to women makes sense, I guess, because these are like straight guys running it.
Yeah, so we're like, oh, well, we kind of get it. Like, yeah. we're kind of on that. Yeah.
I'd hook up with her, too. So I can't be mad at that. Yeah.
Can we, now that we've talked about Nazis.
Yeah.
I actually, this is something, I don't know how much of an expert you are in this, but I'd love to talk with you about street harassment.
Okay.
Because that's, like, a big issue right now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's a hot topic.
Yeah.
So, can you tell me a little bit about like what's going on in the world about street harassment? Not like, the world, like the U.S.
Covering it or
just what the conversation is right
okay.
now.
Okay, so I definitely want to give a shout out to Holla Back as the like global initiative against this, and street harassment, of course, varies dramatically from place to place, and one of the things that I always have to clarify for someone who doesn't think it exists is for most women, especially young women in major cities, it's every day. If you are a person who drives everywhere, you may not encounter it. If you're a person who lives in a rural area and odds are good that you're gonna know most of the people you see every day, it's probably not a problem for you. It might be. But that for most young women living in cities around the world, it is a problem. And so Holla Back is all about, rather than just like internalizing whatever negative feelings you might have as a woman who experiences it, to turn it around and make it that person's deal. Like, why should I be ashamed? It's your bad action. So it started out as a woman, I think in New York originally, who would take pictures of the guys that had harassed her.
Oh, and, you know,
would like Holla Back. And so she was posting online, this is the dude and this is what he said and it's his shame, not mine. And then it started popping up in London, and it was, you know, just every US city has its own. And so it's all about women sharing their experiences and validating that it happened and it's real and that you're right to be feeling whatever way you feel about it. And letting men know that it's going on, because there are a lot of men who are unaware of it because they either just if they don't engage in it in themselves, then they just haven't seen it, because it doesn't usually happen when it's just like some other dude standing there and could do something about it. That's not usually the case. And other men are unaware of how their actions are actually being perceived by women. A common argument is like, it's a compliment. You should take it's a compliment. Sometimes people are trying to make compliments, and you can, as a young woman, I feel like you can usually tell when that's happening.
Yeah, if somebody says, hey, your shirt is really nice.
Yeah.
That's a lot different than, I like the way that shirt looks on you.
Or like, you know, this, I ride a bike, so I get the, can I have a ride once a day? And it's like, no, like I'm going someplace. Like, no. Thanks? No. But letting people also know that it's like part of a larger systemic problem, that like women are unsafe. It's not just the words. It's the fact that this dude might well attack you. You don't know. It happens. You know, like someone could be like, your odds of getting like randomly raped on the street are really low compared to like one of, you know, someone in your family. Well, that's true, but that doesn't make it okay. Like, yeah, I'm safer now than I was as an 8-year-old with that uncle or whatever, sure, but that doesn't mean that my risk is somehow gone, or that the fact I am now currently still at way more risk than you are means that I should just calm down. Like, As a cyclist, I experience this every day, and I read other people's stories, and it's just like women are just like exhausted by it. Mm-hmm. It's just stop. Just stop inflicting your inner wants onto women. You know, just
right.
manage your emotions. Just keep it together, you know?
Is it always sexual?
Is the motivation always sexual?
Is the harassment always sexual?
Or
for the most part, maybe. I don't know.
Like, street harassment could be kind of whatever. Like, just yelling at somebody you don't know about whatever is, you know, counts as street harassment because, you know, their body looks like something that you find interesting or, like, is unusual. Or, I mean, it would be the same if, I don't know if people who are, like, visibly physically disabled encounter it much, but it would mm-hmm. be basically the same thing, which is just like, I see you, I have a reaction to you, I'm gonna make it your problem.
Mm. So it doesn't have to be sexual, but it generally is.
I think the conversations that are happening now about street harassment mm-hmm. tend to be about young women being harassed by men.
Okay.
I think that's a lot of it. But it doesn't, street harassment doesn't have to be. It could be racially motivated, right. It could be whatever. But thinking about who is it that is targeted the most often, we're going to see, like, predictable patterns. It's mm-hmm. not a thing that happens to, like, middle-aged, middle-class men very often. Especially right. white ones. You know, like, I don't think that it happens to them very often.
And the solution to this problem is not for young women to start harassing middle-aged men, sexually harassing them on the street.
I don't think it would be effective.
Nor would it make our society a better place to live if everybody is just catcalling all the time.
And that's actually an argument that, like, I get largely from adult men who are like, well, if a woman did it to me, I wouldn't freak out. I'm like, yeah,
because you don't know what it's like.
Well, yeah, and then odds are good. She also isn't, like, standing too close in your personal space with 100 pounds on you, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's probably not the case that she could kick your ass.
Right.
Possibly, but probably not. And so that's an element of it. Like, you know, like, I have plenty of stories where, like, I was riding my bike and somebody's hauling out the window, and technically the things they're saying are supposed to be come-ons. Technically the things they're saying are supposed to be, like, things I should be grateful to hear about what mm-hmm. my ass looks like. But I'm riding my bike and they're in a huge truck and they are then pressing me between their moving truck and parked cars. I'm in physical danger. Mm-hmm. If this person feels like not giving me enough space, I'm dead.
Right.
You know, I've had people follow me, like, and then I'll speed up and they'll catch up, or I'll slow down and they'll just stay next to me. You know, that's not appealing.
No.
That's not how you'd win my heart over. So instead it's just kind of like, no, I don't think this is meant to be a compliment. I meant this. I feel like you're 16 and you're just being a bully.
Yeah. And you just don't know how to act.
Yeah.
I mean, you cycle everywhere around mm-hmm. the city.
Yeah.
And that kind of, like, fits in. I mean, it is your mode of transportation, but also, like, you have made a career as a fitness instructor as well.
Yeah.
So, like, what I know that you teach mostly group fitness classes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's that experience been like?
Teaching group X.
Yeah.
Love it. It's my favorite. It is so my favorite. Even on the worst days, I still have, like, so much gratitude that I get to do this every day. I am a part of a lot of people's, like, respite from the real world. I get to be the facilitator of a lot of people's best part of their day. And that feels amazing. And to know that I'm part of people's journey of, like, betterment. I've gotten to hear some of those stories mm-hmm. where someone comes up and they're like, you know, I am in this change period. I'm, like, getting my stuff together school-wise or career-wise, and, like, getting my fitness on and, like, really thinking about my health for the first time in my life. And you're a part of this progress. And I, you know, I've been coming every single week, and, like, these are the things that are happening with my body. Like, I'm feeling stronger. I'm feeling like I like myself more, like, whatever the case may be. And that's, like, so cool to hear that the thing you do for your job is actually making people feel good. Like, not just, like, pushing papers around and, like, at the end of the day, well, I got paid for right. my time. It's like immensely rewarding. And Of course, I'm just like flooded with endorphins constantly. Right. So that helps too. So I love it. It's a thing that for whatever reason is still mostly women too. So I get to be in mostly women spaces where, you know, I can make women feel safe and powerful and like throw in some sexy moves. And so I get to bring it all in together. I feel tremendously grateful.
Some of my classmates at the School of Public Health took your burlesque class at SWET.
Oh, okay.
Did you teach a burlesque class? Maybe it was like a flirty
girl.
Yes.
That they was took a class that I taught for a long time. Yeah.
Yes. And they loved it.
It's like those video vixen moves, you know, like you get to,
oh, the like from music videos.
Yeah. Like that kind of stuff. Right. So you're going to get sweaty. You're going to like raise your heart. You're going to get like the calorie burn and the strength and all that kind of stuff. But rather than just doing burpees and like doing like sort of very masculine workout, it's like super feminized movements. Like it's a lot of hips. It's very like smooth lines. It's a lot of like being sexy, like overtly being sexy. And you're doing it in a space where it's for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a mirror. You can watch yourself if you want to. And very, very few men have ever taken this class. And the ones that have been flaming. And so, you know, you get to feel totally safe about it. You don't get to feel like observed and judged at all. It's just, you know, like we're having fun and people like being sexy. They like it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun. So, you know, like what's not to love?
Yeah, I've definitely heard good things about that class from my classmates.
I'm glad so, you had a good time.
Yeah. So, I mean, the one of the issues that I've come up against in learning more about public health in my program is, I mean, I am exposed to a lot of sex and sexuality information and experiences through your podcast.
Oh, right on. Thanks.
And yeah, and we don't talk about any of that stuff in school. It's, I mean, we do talk about behavior.
Yeah.
We talk about, you know, people doing risky behavior and being in denial about it, but we don't talk about, or we haven't yet talked about in any classes I've taken. Maybe there are classes that I missed that they do talk about it. Particularly issues of gender and sexual orientation. And we had a guest speaker come in our very first quarter who was a trans woman, and you would be amazed at how many people didn't know what being trans meant.
Yeah.
And it was in a master's health program. You know, yeah. I could imagine general public not having a great handle on what it means, but do you have any insight as to why health care and public health and things like that just don't talk about those issues?
Well, I mean, it's like you're saying, like it doesn't come up in the program, you know, and that's true for medical doctors as well. Like most med students don't get much sexuality. If they do, they might have 1 week where they have someone like me come in, or odds are good, actually, someone who's getting their master's in sexuality come in and talk about stuff with, you know, the expectation you're going to like cover as much as possible, like in this incredibly short amount of time. And that's going to be adequate for the rest of their career. You know, you might have 3 hours devoted to birth control pills. And they're going to be mostly interested in, you know, medical side effecty stuff. Not when you're talking to a 14-year-old girl, prescribing her birth control, should you also have a conversation about like safer sex behaviors and possibly screening for violence and, you know, not necessarily that every sexually active 14-year-old is experiencing sexual violence, but there was a study that came out recently about how most doctor-teen interactions, sex never comes up.
Really?
Most teens do not talk to their doctors about sex. Most doctors do not ask teens about sex. Most doctors don't ask anybody about sex, partly because they don't have the training. They really don't actually have that much more information. So if somebody does go to their doctor about a sexual health issue, you're just going to hope that you stumble upon one of those doctors who finds that stuff particularly interesting and knows of their own accord. If you go to like a gynecologist or urologist, they're likely to have a little bit more training in those sort of things.
I should hope so.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean they necessarily understand sexual dysfunctions, it doesn't mean they have any grasp on how relationships affect sexuality. It doesn't mean they have much training in domestic violence situations, or that they would understand what it means to be trans, or why you would care about the sexual orientation of someone when you're doing like a basic screening. So like a very common experience for lesbian women who go into their doctors is they'll be asked, are you sexually active? Yes. Are you on birth control? No. Why not? And then, I mean, you have to come out to your doctor, which is whatever, it's fine. But like before you either have to just from the jump be like, I'm a big old lesbian, or else they're going to be, why aren't you on the pill? Right. Like, don't you understand? Da, 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 da. And like, I understand. Yeah. Thank you.
It's really not a problem for me.
Yeah. And we really, really, really need to make it safe for trans people to go get medical screenings. Like trans men are still at risk of, you know, a lot of, you know, basic medical problems like cervical cancer, mm-hmm. and, you know, all those sort of things. Like 75% of sexually active people have HPV, you know, like, and if you're not getting screened somehow, how do you know what's going on?
Right.
Because you can't see it. And so it's very uncomfortable for a lot of trans people to go to the doctor, and then you have to come out and you have to have this awkward conversation with someone who may not use the right pronouns and probably feels awkward about it also. And then it just discourages them from coming back. And so they don't get screened for everything, you know, diabetes, heart problems, etc. If you don't feel safe going to the doctor, you're not gonna go.
Right. Because just because you're trans doesn't mean that every health issue you have is related to sex.
Yeah, in some true.
Way. I mean, absolutely. You're still like a person,
yeah.
with other organs that can malfunction.
Imagine that.
I know. And I think that that's also part of the conversation that is problematic, is that when you talk about, I mean, we can say this with any group. You talk about one group of people, you talk about gay men, and HIV is the first thing that comes up when you think about health problems. But gay men have all of the same health problems that every other person has. And just because they're gay doesn't mean that that's what their health issues or their health questions are limited to.
And this is also like an emerging issue among the like body positive movement, the adipositivity movement, that like if somebody is overweight, that doesn't mean that every health problem is related to their weight.
Mm-hmm.
They might be exercising regularly. They might have some health issue unrelated to that, but doctors are more likely to judge overweight patients. They're more likely to have negative reactions to them. They're more likely to attribute every problem to their mm-hmm. weight, that sort of thing. And it's just through lack of discussion about these things. And so from the very beginning, like you're talking about, it's not in classes. And so if you're a doctor and you're just like operating the world, doing your thing, like hopefully you're getting continuing education, you're going to conferences, but I don't know how much conferences are talking about sexuality issues. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. It seems like doctors are the place that people go with their sex questions, but that, you know, unless they specifically know a lot about STIs, they understand, you know, like those sort of things. Yeah. A doctor will know more than a sex educator, sometimes about those things. But, there's a lot of fear, and that's not just the medical profession. That's, I mean, sexuality touches on everything, but people are scared to talk about it. I had a new student this semester who is an art therapist, and she said sex comes up constantly in the trauma that people have, mm-hmm. or the way that symptoms manifest, or the things that, you know, are bothering people, etc. Art therapists receive zero sex training. Zero.
Really?
Not a moment of it. None. You might have one professor who's particularly, you know, sex positive, and maybe they bring some stuff up. But I've spoken to 6 or 7 art therapists, dance therapists, those sort of people, and they're like, no, never.
What are
never,
they
never,
learning never. About?
You know, art,
you should be learning about trauma.
About art therapy, I don't know. They said that they don't get any sexuality discussions. And so, like, this one particular student was like, all right, so now I'm going to go get a sex degree too, because I want to do art therapy holistically and comprehensively. Mm-hmm. So
that's a big gap in medical, and it sounds like there's some
in
some,
other yeah, like lots in of fields.
Basic psych type
yeah,
stuff.
If we can't talk about sex, except for in these very limited, like commodified, commercialized, you know, like naked thin women's bodies equals sex, you know, like right. we see sex all the time. What are you talking about? Sex is everywhere. It's on all the TVs. It's on the internet. It's everywhere. It's all the time. In fact, it can't get out of my face. No, no. That's the objectification of young, usually white, very narrow conception of beauty. That's what that is. That's a totally different thing. That's not sex. That's not right. sexuality. That's not a real discussion of what actual people's lives are like. Like, actual sex, real sex, you don't see that on TV.
No.
And I'm not just saying, like, do you ever get to see graphic penetration? That's not what I'm talking about either. I'm talking about, like, you know, a realistic sex scene that is fumbling and funny. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somebody knocks over something at some point and you have to stop because, like, something got bent weird, hair got pulled, you know?
Right.
Like, real issues with real bodies we don't actually see.
And maybe we should? Is that what's implied there at the end of that?
I am of the belief that if it's real, it should be represented in art and culture and news, I think.
Okay.
I think that would be fair to say. And I think it would be educationally beneficial to have more realistic representations of bodies and sexuality, because we get conditioned to think that sex looks like a certain thing. Mm-hmm. Romance looks like a certain thing. If it's not some crazy story of Ryan Gosling like hunting you down and forcing you to date him, it's not real love.
Right.
You know, and if after your fight he doesn't, you know, buy a car and fill a, you know, restaurant full of candles, it's not, you know, you shouldn't forgive him. And like, you know, if her body doesn't look like this and work this way and all this sort of stuff, then, it, you know, she's bad and just stupid stuff like that.
Right.
Ludicrous notions of how our lives should be tailored to fit sitcoms.
So it would be just healthier for everybody if things were a little more realistic.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on that note, if somebody wants to get in touch with you or wants to, you know, read your stuff or hear your stuff,
they would podcast. Be yeah, they'd be welcome.
How
to do so.
How could they do that?
Sexwithtimaree.com. And then I have
Timaree is TIMAREE.
That's a good point. That's yeah. a very good point. It's not a normal name. we have a pretty active Sex with Timaree Facebook page where like we have conversations about stuff and I post things and people respond and it's great.
And it's can get pretty heated.
It can.
And it can. Very interesting.
And then you know, I'm on Twitter, and I have the podcast, which is available through most all the podcast things. You got iTunes mm-hmm. and Podbay and all those sort of things. So just Google Sex with Timaree and you'll have lots of different options for how to interact with me.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
So that's Timaree. It's always a pleasure talking with her. I hope that you guys enjoyed hearing what she has to say. She's just thought so much about these issues. Obviously, she's a doctor. She has a doctorate in human sexuality. She's definitely thought about these things more than I have. So I always appreciate talking to her because I get to learn from her. And I appreciate her, like, very positive and accepting way of looking at human sexuality and sexual behavior and kind of taking a more holistic look at those things rather than I think what at least I have found a tendency towards kind of isolating those behaviors from greater, you know, from the whole person. That's, yeah, I don't know, sometimes that happens in public health. So this week's action item, I've got two for you. One, if you live in Philadelphia, don't currently take classes with Timaree, I challenge you to track her down. I'm sure it's super easy. Throw her name in Google and stuff is going to come up. And take one of her classes because I know for a fact that she's an excellent dancer and I'm sure that all of like her dance fitness classes are amazing. The second thing that I want you to consider is like if you're a student or if you're working in public health or you know however you're involved, this week, bring up sexuality in some way. And that's just not sexual behavior. We're not just talking about using condoms or not using condoms. We're talking about gender identity, sexual orientation, all that kind of good stuff. Bring it up at a relevant time, obviously. Don't be crazy. Bring it up at, like, you know, talking about meatballs or something. And kind of push the conversation to consider those issues. And you may come up against some resistance, but you may also find that you're able to push the conversation into a realm that you haven't talked about before. Who knows? Maybe you could have, like, the major breakthrough in your group about the piece that you're missing. So give it a shot. As always, thank you for listening, and I will be back with you next week. Thanks so much for listening to Action Phase. You can find me, Tegan, on Twitter at Tegan Keating. That's TEAGANKEATING. And on my site, TeganK.com. You can find Action Phase on Twitter at Action Phase Pod and on ActionPhasePodcast.com. You can feel free to email me at ActionPhasePodcast@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.